my secret hope for teachers is that they find some sovereignty in their business. And I think that doing registered series is one of the best ways to sail your own ship so that you're not reliant on a specific location or a specific studio. If eventually that location doesn't work out, you've got a nest full of students that you can just move that nest to a new location because they're actually there for you and the connection and the community and their practice.
You're listening to the Yoga Teacher Resource Podcast. Knowledge, techniques, and inspiration for your teaching and your practice. I'm your host, Mado Hesselink. If you're a yoga teacher who loves learning, is passionate about spreading the benefits of yoga, and desires more resources to support your teaching, you're in the right place. Let's get started with today's episode.
My guest on the podcast today is Nick Danu, that's spelled N-Y-K. Nick is a certified yoga therapist, a yin yoga teacher, and a yoga business mentor. She lives in the enchanted city of Victoria on magical Vancouver Island, her words, where she teaches yoga misfits, those who are not human pretzels, alternative folks, the underdogs, rebels, geeks, introverts, and bookworms. I definitely identify with some of those labels. When Nick is not teaching yoga, you will find her expanding her tattoo collection, walking by the ocean, or curled up at home watching Star Trek or immersed in a book. Nick also hosts a podcast all about yin yoga. So if you enjoyed listening to her today or you're curious to learn more about yin yoga, you can search for Yin Yoga Podcast on your favorite podcast player.
I'm excited to talk about registered series. I know you're a huge fan. What do you love about them?
I was teaching for probably about 15 years before I ever experienced a drop-in class as a teacher. Because I started with registered series right out of the gate. And then when I started teaching drop-in classes, I was like, whoa, this is a whole other animal. I don't love this at all. So there's a lot of things I love about them. Primarily, the biggest love that I have for them is actually the connection with the students and their connection to each other. So building community is really important to me. It's one of my values as a business. And when you have a series of students that are practicing together for a window of time, it really helps to build that rapport, not just between you, but between them as well. And I just think, especially after COVID, people are just longing for some real community and connection again.
How about as a student? Did you take registered series before you started teaching? What was your experience from the student's perspective?
So I started practicing in 1998. There were only two major studios at the time in the city that I lived in. And one was an Ashtanga-based studio. So they had Mysore practice, which is not registered, but the practitioners are very dedicated, typically. And then the other studio was kind of a mix of different kinds of teachers. It had some Hatha teachers, some Iyengar teachers, and that one was registered series. There was no drop-ins. So you would pick a class based on your experience and your time that you were available. You would sign up for, I think they were 6 or 8 weeks or something like that. And then you would just go to class. And so it never occurred to me that there was another option. But I do think that had there been a drop-in option, I would have been less dedicated. But because I had already booked that time in my schedule, it was on, you know, my day off, and I had already paid the money, I showed up. I liked that it also allowed the teacher an opportunity to get to know each of us. And so, you know, each week you actually were greeted by name and they knew about your injuries and what you were working on. And so, yeah, it just felt, especially even for someone like myself, who tends to be a bit of a misfit, it felt really connected and not so anonymous. And then, you know, of course, years later, I went to a couple of drop-in classes. And yeah, it was very much like nobody even knew whether you were there or not, really, to be honest, like, because there were so many people and if you just kind of wandered in and took a spot. And so, yeah, so a lot less personal, a lot less heartfelt, definitely not that aspect of community. That was my experience. And that's why I think when I first started teaching, I gravitated towards series. And they were still fairly common back then, not as common as when I first started yoga, but that's why I just automatically went towards registered series. It just seemed to make more sense to me. both from a sort of heartfelt perspective, but also just from a financially sustainable perspective. I really don't think that drop-in classes are a good model for studios, for sure, teachers. And I also don't think they're that good for the students. I think that students think they want that flexibility of just being able to like, oh, I'll just show up whenever it fits for my schedule. But the reality is, it's one. Now you've just added one more thing to their to-do list. Now they have to remember they want to go to yoga. They have to get online. They have to book the spot. And if their class is full, they have to try to book a different spot, which might not be the time they normally go. So now they have to try to remember and put that in their calendar. And it just becomes a whole ordeal for them to just get to yoga, which I often will say to my students that that's what they think they want. But actually what they want is things to just be simple. They just want to know, I have a yoga class once, twice, three times a week, whatever it is for them. It's on this day at this time. I show up. I see the same people. The teacher knows my name. The teacher knows my injuries. And it's in my calendar and it's done, you know?
So it sounds like you've seen a trend away from registered series since you've been teaching. Why do you think that is?
I would say that once yoga's being started offered in gyms, because gyms are drop-in, then I think that yoga studios started to feel like they needed to compete with that, which is a choice because they could have done the opposite, right? There's this, I always butcher the name of the book, but I think it's called Red Ocean, Blue Ocean or Blue Ocean, Red Ocean, where they talk about how one of the worst ways to run a business is to try to compete with everybody else. So had studios, because then it's just like a bunch of piranhas, you know, all going after the same little fish. Whereas if you just go do your own thing, then it's clear over there. And I think that studios had an opportunity at that point to say, okay, gyms are now offering yoga, but what we do isn't fitness yoga. What we do is we explore yoga on a deeper level. We build community. We build connection. We have consistency. What we do is so different than the yoga they would get in the gym. And I'm not knocking gym yoga. I mean, I know tons of people that have found yoga through the gym. But I just think it's sort of like apples and oranges. And I feel like if studios had decided instead of, oh, I'm feeling threatened by this fitness model, that means that's what we have to do now. And they would have gone, actually, let's stay in our lane over here and just get better at explaining the difference to students and offering things that they're not going to get at a fitness-based studio or a fitness-based class. I think it would have made a big difference. And so I think that's why there was that shift. I think there was a lot of like fear and kind of competition that came up. But then what happened is it just made yoga less and less sustainable for studios. And I think that even those who didn't already know that, I've definitely witnessed it over the last few years. I mean, in my little city, we've lost 9 yoga studios. That's a lot. And some of them were iconic legacy studios that had been around for a decade or more. So, you know, when you have that kind of drop-in model, you're always counting on how many students can I cram in so we can keep the lights on? And, you know, it didn't work, obviously.
There's definitely been a huge shift in the way that people are interacting with yoga over the last 3-4 years. So given that there's now an opportunity, but also a requirement or a need for independent yoga teachers to take ownership of their teaching, there are fewer studio jobs out there. The ones that do exist pay less, are less sustainable, more competitive. It's not a sustainable game to try to teach exclusively in studios. Now, studios are great. If a studio model can exist in a specific area, that's awesome. That could be a really great service for their community. But it's not the only way. And we're not going to be seeing a proliferation of studios because of real estate prices now. Mm-hmm. It's really going to be the independent teachers finding places to teach, teaching out of their homes, teaching online. This is the opportunity. How would a new teacher get started offering registered series?
I'll just talk about how I started running them on my own, and that'll kind of give like a bit of a roadmap. So when I first started teaching yoga, I was teaching registered series, but it was ironically at a gym. It was a bit of a kind of high-end gym, more like country club-ish than fitness. They had tennis pros and all that stuff. And all of their kind of what they considered specialty classes, which yoga was, were registered series. So I rolled right into a registered series, and the manager and I usually decided together start dates, end dates, how long would they be, et cetera. So I started that way. So then in that case, it was still a registered series. Now, that's not how I would do it if I were to start again, but I was getting paid by the hour, and it allowed the gym to know that these classes were sustainable because for this 6 weeks or 8 weeks, this is how much came in. And then it also allowed me to get paid a decent wage as well. A few years in, so I did that for two different gyms, actually, ironically, two different gyms I taught registered series. And the second gym, it was actually a therapeutic class too. It was a back pain class. What happened was the one gym was closing and the students were like, what's going to happen to our back pain class? Like they were just like panicked about it. I had just assumed, well, I was a fairly new teacher. I was like, well, I need to fill my Monday 12 o'clock spot somewhere now. And I was just going to move into somewhere else to teach. And they were really, really adamant that we had to keep these classes going. And so I just said, okay, I'm pretty creative. Let me give me the summer. It was, I think, May, to just kind of ponder this. I got everyone's emails and figure this out. And so I just kind of started walking around because this class was downtown at the time. And I started walking around downtown thinking, where would there be a space that I could use to run these classes myself? And so there's a beautiful church. So I went in and I just went into their office and I said, I'm wondering if you rent out space. And they said, we do. And I said, I'm looking for a lunch hour time for a yoga class. And they said, we have Thursdays at lunch available in September. And I said, I'll take it. And it was just that. I started off at a smaller space that they had. And then as their renters and agreements and stuff shifted, I moved into their little small theater. So I had more space. And that class became one a week and then two a week over lunch hour. And so then that gave me the confidence to know that like, this is something I can do. Because if people downtown on their lunch hour will commit to a registered series, then anybody can commit to a registered series. Now, of course, I have to acknowledge there are people that work shift work, you know, nurses and people like that. Registered's not always best for them. Although if it's on Zoom, they always get the recording. So then it works. So that was how I started. And then that gave me the confidence then when I was working in the area I lived in, there was no yoga studio, no yoga classes. And so I thought, well, this is crazy. So I, again, found a church. This was a long time ago, so this is going to sound a little dated, but I set up a little tiny little ad in the classified of the community newsletter, just letting people know that these classes were starting and that there was a little meet and greet on this night. And the church just let me use the space because they were happy to have, you know, people renting. So they let me use the space for, you know, a couple hours. And I just set up some tea and had some yoga books and like had paper sign up forms because that's how long ago that was. And folks were able to just come and meet me. And I registered, I filled that first 7 week series class within half an hour. And so I added another class directly afterwards and filled that one. Gradually, they brought neighbors and neighbors and neighbors. And before you know it, I had 10 classes in that neighborhood where I was renting space. So that's how I started. And of course, there was lots of learnings along the way, you know, but things that I needed to do. I just kind of winged it. And then when something didn't work out, went, okay, we need a policy around this, or we need a form for this, or we need, you know, and that's how it started. And it allowed me, when I did leave the second gym finally, and I had another church space that I rented, and then at that point was now all self-run, having those spaces renting them allowed me to double my income and not charge the students more and have complete sovereignty over the experience that they were going to have for the most part. We can't always control a whole building, but one of the things that I was starting to find frustrating at one of the gyms that I taught at is the room was freezing cold and it took me 2 years to convince them they needed to buy blankets for yoga. Whereas when I was running my own, I was just like, oh, we need this. I'll get it. Or people are telling me that 15 minutes later on this class would be better. We'll make it so. So it cut out that middleman, so to speak, and really allowed me to serve my students more effectively and build my community, but then also allowed me the sustainability as a teacher to not have to teach 15 to 20 classes a week and, experience all that burnout and still actually be able to, eat organic and throw some money in the bank.
Let's talk about the basic building blocks. What are the items or considerations needed for a yoga teacher to run their own pre-registered series?
So there's two ways that you can do it. If you work in a studio and you're just really not sure about this whole subletting space, having to do it all yourself thing, you could actually approach the studio. And I would recommend if you're going to do a registered series in that case that you come up with some sort of a theme. It's a great way to try on a niche if you don't have a niche and see if you like it. If you already have a niche, it's a great way to really sort of hone in on, a 6-week series around a specific themed thing, whether it's, prenatal or eye back care, whatever your thing is. And if you could go to a studio and say that you already teach at and say, I'd really like to offer this in this way. And if you've got it all mapped out, including like dates, times, et cetera, then most studios are going to say yes, because you're not creating more work for them. You're saying, here, I have this. This is what I'd like to do. And then in that case, it would be probably more of a similar pay structure to a workshop where it's like, I think commonly it's like 60-40 or 70-30. So you're still, as the teacher, going to make the majority of that money, but you're not going to have to register the students or worry about props or anything like that. So if you have that flexibility at a studio you teach at, that's a good way to kind of just dip your toe in the water and see, like, how does this work? Do I like this? If that's not an option, I would still recommend that you try to keep your series themed. I think it's a lot more likely that you're going to attract people that are willing to commit if there's sort of a theme to it. So for example, back care in my case, pre or postnatal, I work with a teacher who works with triathletes. So she has like a series for them. It's very themed. It's very obvious who it's for. It's easy for them to commit. And then look around your city and try to find a space that is suitable. So clean, warm, and quiet is all you need. It doesn't have to be fancy. It's nice if the lighting's adjustable too. That's like an extra win. But clean, warm, and quiet. So I did mostly churches or kind of non-for-profit community rooms and rented that kind of thing. But there's a whole bunch of places that, you could do. Art studios, for example, most of them are closed at night, so it's like, that's a beautiful space just sitting there empty. So if you know somebody who is an artist or has a space or, somebody who owns a studio space, so that you can really get creative with it. Any space that isn't being used when you might be wanting to teach, don't think that just because they don't rent to yoga teachers already, that they're not open to it, because they probably would be. Especially if you make it easy and just say, hey, how about I show up when you're closed, I give the floor a quick sweep, and I hand you some money and I use your space. Most people are going to be like, yes, please. So that would be the start, is finding the location that you can work with. Things to consider are like parking, or if it's in a neighborhood, is it walkable, like that kind of stuff. If it's downtown in the city you teach in, that's not as relevant because people have already commuted and they're already there. Those things are things to consider about the space. You will logistically have to have insurance. Most yoga teachers probably do, but you'll want to call your insurance company and just make sure that the space is mentioned on your insurance policy. Most spaces will want that. And that's so like, you know, if you use candles in a class or something, and you burn down the building, you know, they're covered. It's never happened, but you know, that's just one little thing you'll want to do when you find the space is, you know, get the name and the address of the corporation and all that, and just add that to your insurance. So that's kind of the often the hardest part is just finding the space. And then I think it's just policies after that.
Yeah, I do agree that finding the space can be daunting for folks. And what I think would be a great idea is to identify the area that you want to be in and then take an afternoon and walk mm-hmm. and wander and daydream and think about what you're trying to create. And look at every single place you see with an open mind and ask yourself the questions. Could people park here? Could they be warm enough? Is it going to be clean enough? Is it going to be safe? If you wander around, that's going to give you the opportunity to think outside the box and to get really creative. One of my favorite pre-registered series that I ever taught was at the local arboretum in their bonsai Ooh, garden.
Lovely. How lovely.
It was really cool. Yeah. So almost anything is possible, mm-hmm. but you just have to have that spark of recognition that it could be a match. So we need a theme.
That's exactly when you said walk around. That's exactly what I did when that gym was closing. I literally just took a lunch hour and walked around downtown, like going, what's down here that I might be able to use, you know? At one point I was thinking like, oh, a convention center, but that would have obviously been out of budget. But then as soon as I saw a church, I was like, oh, this makes sense. But yeah, it could be an art gallery or, I mean, who knows? You'll really, if you can keep your mind open and walk around just thinking safe, clean, quiet, warm, there's a lot of spaces that fit that bill.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. So you have a theme and you have a space. Two other things that came to me as being needed requirements are registration and or payment and communication. Mm-hmm. We need to allow people to sign up and we need to be able to let them know if class is canceled or remind them when class is happening, remind them to sign up for the next series. So this is some decisions to make. Nick, what do you do for registration? What do you use?
For my email service, I use ConvertKit. I was on MailChimp's free version for years, and then I just eventually outgrew it. But so I use that. And then I use OfferingTree for sign up. I've used Acuity in the past too, and I quite liked Acuity. The only reason I kind of shifted over to OfferingTree from Acuity is that I found that Acuity didn't offer me sliding scale options without having to give people a bunch of coupon codes, and that was just getting messy. Whereas with OfferingTree, I was able to just set tiered pricing. So, but if you're not going to offer tiered pricing, that isn't something that you'd have to worry about. The thing I like about any of those softwares is they do so much for you.
Yeah, the other thing about Acuity is that you cannot really send email broadcasts through them to your students. Basically, if you try to message everybody registered for a class, it's going to open up your email client and it's going to try to send them a personal email. That is not best practice for a lot of reasons that are out of the scope of this conversation, but I do have other podcast episodes that go into why that's not a good idea. Mm-hmm. OfferingTree, I think, is awesome, super cost effective for what they offer. You know, we expect a lot from our technology these days. We have really high standards, and OfferingTree offers a lot of features for the price. But you could go really, really low tech as well. You could communicate through text message. I will say that I do not recommend using your personal email to communicate with your students about your classes and about your business. I know a lot of people do it, and nobody's going to put you in jail for it. But it really is not how you're going to set yourself up for future success, basically, doing it that way. So we have location, clients, registration, communication. You've talked about insurance, And then you mentioned policies. Tell me about the policies that you have in place that really work for you.
Yeah. So each one of these were, learned by mistakes because at the beginning, I didn't have any policies and then things would come up and I'd go, oh, maybe I need a little fine print section or a policy section. So one is that spots are not held without payment. Somebody saying they're interested doesn't mean they are interested until they've given you their money. So that was one, because I'd have numerous people that would say, oh yeah, I'm totally in. And then day one of class, they're not there. So yeah. So payment ensures your spot. The second one is classes are not prorated to reflect absences. So if somebody signs up for your 8-week series and they know that they're going to be gone for one of those weeks because it's their anniversary or they're going somewhere, they just, depending on how you have it set up, they just have to be okay with the fact that they're not going to be there for that class. You're not going to give them their small amount for that class back or deduct it. So that is something. So classes are not prorated because that becomes a nightmare. And then I also had a policy that once classes had started, no refunds would be offered. And this was, again, same thing. I don't want somebody to just, I'm going to just say it, flake out, you know? Now, that being said, there were a couple times where something serious came up, a death in the family or a student breaks their leg. And so you can have that policy and still have humanity. And so in those cases, I just offered them a credit on their next series. So if they'd already done 4 and they had 2 weeks left, I just would, adjust it for the next semester. If they were suddenly moving away or something, I might consider it as well. Most of my classes at a point ended up having a wait list. So it wasn't impossible for me to reach out to that list and say, a spot's come up. And then in that case, I'd be able to refund their money. But for the most part, once it begins, no refunds.
One thing that I've learned over the years is it's a lot easier to start with really strict policies, start with the strongest boundaries you think you might need. And then in the moment, you are the boss. You can always make exceptions. Mm-hmm. But if you're setting the expectation that these policies are the strongest boundaries that you can imagine needing, then instead of having to, first of all, make those decisions on the fly and then feel like you're disappointing people or they're, upset with you because you're not being kind or generous, you get to play the generous person. Mm-hmm. You get to be generous and understanding by shifting the policies to the degree of the situation based on how understandable or how impactful is their circumstance. And then you can respond to that instead of having to kind of set the boundary in relationship to the circumstance, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. And again, I learned these the hard way. So, please, dear teachers, learn from my mistakes, have some policies in place. I think that was it for policies. One other little thing, which wasn't really a policy, but that I started doing as these classes started taking off, was I would give existing students, when it was time to open registration for the next semester, I would give existing students 2 weeks to jump ahead before I would send out emails saying, hey, spring yoga is open. And so that worked really well. Usually someone would only snooze once and then potentially lose their spot before they'd be like, oh, you really meant like the spot will fill. Yeah. So I didn't start that right away because, of course, when they were new, they were full, but I didn't have a wait list. So, but once there started to be a wait list of people asking about the classes, then, I started to build that into my email software so that then, I would just give everybody in the class notice first. They'd have 2 weeks and then I would open it up. And again, you can start pretty low tech. Like I just mentioned offering tree and acuity. And I would say if you're just starting, you can grow into that. But when I started, and now this is going to date me again, I started with a paper registration form with a waiver attached and checks stapled to or cash, envelopes of cash. And that's how I filled my first class. So Even when I started doing classes on Zoom, when we were all shut down, I started super low tech with like a document with people's email addresses and how much they paid and on what date and how they paid, and they e-transferred me. So you just want to make sure still that people understand that until you receive the money, they don't have their spot, but you can start small. And then as things build, then you can add in the software to help you to keep track of it and take your work down. But, you know, I'm all about bootstrapping it to start.
For sure. For sure. And if your population is mostly older folks, they might actually really appreciate it if you keep the technology very simple. And it might be refreshing. And they're like, wow, I feel so much more comfortable doing it this way. This is how I've done it all my life.
Yeah. Just having a paper form and a check for if you work with seniors is going to be great for them. Exactly. You just have to make sure they bring their glasses, because sometimes I've had that happen where it's like, oh, I can't read this waiver. I'm like, all right, I'll read it out to you. But yeah, that's, you know, that's a great way to do it. And then you're getting their registration all before they even leave the room. So it's not like a thing they have to remember.
Yeah. And I want to really highlight that if you're doing series back to back, you want to get the commitment from your students before the next series start. Don't wait for the first day and say, oh yeah, you can sign up for the next week on that first week. I would give them at least 2 weeks where you have a deadline and you have a minimum. Actually, let's talk about that. Let's talk about minimums because not everybody's going to have a wait list right when they start. Not everybody's going to be filled up. So how would you work with a new offering that you are not sure it's going to fill? How would you handle minimums and whether or not to cancel?
That is another thing I didn't mention that I do put in my policies, that this class needs a minimum number to run so that it's the seed is planted. First, I would say one way to kind of ensure that your series will fill is to offer a one-off workshop on whatever theme it is that you're going to do in the series. And to do that a few weeks before you want to do a series, so that you can then say at the end, you know, if you really like this, we can dive so much deeper into this in the series that I'm offering. So sometimes that's a great way to kind of whet people's appetite and really have them understand, because, you know, it is challenging sometimes for people to picture committing to a series when they've never experienced you as a teacher. So that can be a great way to start with a little workshop that's themed so that they can just move then from that into the series.
If you do that, make sure that you give them a reason to sign up at the workshop for the series. Don't just say, hey, there's a series happening. Let me know if you want to sign up. But give them an actual reason to sign up that day while they're excited, while it's top of mind, because people are busy and there's a lot going on in our lives. And so if you let them leave without signing up, that's fine if they want to, but if they want to sign up, give them a reason to sign up that day. That reason could be perhaps a slight discount for signing up that day, or some kind of bonus, some kind of extra. Or if you do think that the series will fill, then they can reserve their spot that way.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of bonuses versus discounts. And it could be something inexpensive. Like, I think every student could benefit from a little eye pillow. You know, so it doesn't have to be, or their own yoga strap or something. It doesn't have to be huge. So definitely a minimum. So how I crunched the numbers on my minimum was I knew how much it cost me to pay for the space. I knew ideally at the lowest level, what do I want to be paid? So definitely not less than what I was making at a studio. So like, what's my kind of minimum amount that I'm okay with? Add those together. Figure out over the course of the weeks and then just do the math on like how many people would it take to pay the space and pay my minimum. So that's your minimum number. And then of course, anything past that is just going to be gravy. So that's how I did the number crunching, was how much is the space going to cost me? How much do I want to make per week, you know, per class as a minimum, and then figured that out and then just literally did the math and that was how it worked.
And how far ahead of time do you make that call?
Well, for me, because a lot of it depends on the space you're renting. So you need to find out what their policies are, because if they have a 30-day cancellation, you don't want to be paying for that space for 4 weeks that you didn't use. So I would say that would determine it. And if they're open, like if they're kind of like, well, whatever, then I would say for me, at least 7 days, ideally more. I'm one of those plan ahead kind of folks. So I like, you know, when you were talking about, you know, getting people geared up for the next session when they're in a session, I usually started, let's just say, I'm just going to pull a number out of a hat. Let's just say the series was 8 weeks. 4 weeks into that series, so at the halfway point is when I would start telling people, you have 2 weeks to jump ahead of the rest of the group. So by week six, they're all either in or out. That gives me 2 weeks to fill the next space. And I would often have a small gap in between semesters. Not always, but it usually worked out where it's like, oh, and now it's Christmas time, so let's take a break. That gives you an opportunity to fill it. You know, oh, if I can end it before Easter and then start the next one after Easter, which is a little tricky because Easter moves, but then that kind of gives you again a little window there where you have a few extra days or a week to fill it up. But what will happen eventually if it starts going well and people are loving it is that you will have people that, you know, want to sign up in advance and you'll have a wait list and it'll just make it so much smoother. But when you're starting out, you just more notice is it's I think it's always better to have more time to mention and promote something than to have less. Like, So yeah, at least 4 weeks if it's a brand new series.
And how long do you think is the right amount of time or an optimal amount of time for a series?
This was a bit of a learning as well. So in the beginning, I just did 6, 7, 8 week series, depending on the time of the year, because that's where the places I was teaching at did it. But what started happening was gradually, my regulars were just signing up again and again. And I actually had one of them look at me and say, can't I just give you money for the whole year? Like, why do I have to keep signing up? Why do I have to keep registering? And that's when I was like, oh, I do have a consistent group here. I can extend these. And so now I actually do 12-week seasonal semesters. But I wouldn't start that way. I would start with, I don't think that 4 weeks is enough personally, because I just don't think you get very far before they're now asking them to sign up again. So somewhere between 6, 8 weeks is a good start. And then if you notice that it's consistently the same people, it's really easy to just make the next semester 9 weeks and make the one after that 10 weeks. And so you can gradually kind of add on. And so, yeah, now they're 12 weeks. So the nice thing about that too is when you have a full season, you can introduce seasonal themes. You can change your sequences based on, you know, the time of year. So I really love doing full seasonal semesters. They're 12 weeks now.
And one thing that I was thinking about when we were talking about people missing class is when my daughter takes gymnastics, and what they do is every season they offer a makeup day. So basically anybody who's missed any classes throughout the season gets to get an extra class to make up for it. You don't get two extras, right? If you miss more than one, that's really on you. But it's a courtesy to your students that basically acknowledges, hey, I understand things come up. I want to make sure that I'm giving you all the value that you paid for. Now, this might be more realistic if you run several registered series and then you can make the makeup class like on a Saturday or something like that, where would you want to do a makeup class for just like two or three people? Probably not. But it's something to think about, especially if you feel personally uncomfortable with telling people. Too bad. If you miss a class, you miss a class. It's nice to have something to say, like some policy that feels compassionate and feels reasonable, but isn't being a pushover.
Another thing to do is what I do is I kind of combine those with another marketing strategy. So there is always a seasonal class in between that's just a free class. If they have signed up for my series, it's a thank you for being an awesome student class. If they have been on my email list for a while, kind of snooping around, but aren't quite sure, it's a try before you buy class. It's an opportunity for my existing students to invite friends and family. And so I do a quarterly free class in between each semester. I don't do it for each class, but I do like one for that people can either just come, like you said, if they've missed a class, or if they just wanted extra class, or people can bring their friends, or anyone who's been kind of interested but isn't quite sure now gets a chance to come and experience the community and you as a teacher as well. And so I think that having it that way, it kind of fills the hole in many areas without me having to offer a whole bunch of free classes. So I've been doing one a quarter and it's been going really well.
That's awesome. I love that. So one question that I know a lot of teachers are going to have, especially if they're new teachers and they haven't been teaching regularly at a gym or at a studio yet, and they don't have a following that they feel confident is going to sign up for this registered series, is how do you find people? How do you get that first group together, enough people to make it worth your while?
I would say, and I hate that new teachers probably are going to hate to hear this though, but this is where niching and theming comes in. Let's just use an example of one of my clients who does yoga for triathletes. Well, if she's doing a series for triathletes, but she doesn't actually have enough local triathletes that she knows to fill it, well, now she knows, okay, this is who I'm working with. So I can go to the running shop and I can leave a flyer. I can go on the paths where all the runners are and I can start hanging posters. So in order to decide how to bring them, you have to first know who they are. And then you go where they are and you hand out flyers, you hang posters, you talk to local businesses. So maybe connecting with a, you know, I'll use the run shop as example. One of my students, she's got all these videos that she did on Instagram. And I said to her, have you ever reached out to the running store and just said, hey, I know you're probably swamped with like, what in the world am I going to put in this month's newsletter? I've got this little video that's like a 5-minute, you can use it. And believe me, they are not going to say no. They're like, did you just give me free niche content? Yes. And so then that starts to expose you to those people's community. So the hard work of figuring out how to fill your class starts with who's in the class. What is the theme? What problem am I solving? So for example, if you were doing, I'll just use another one, prenatal. Well, now you know that you can go to all the stores that sell all of the organic cute mommy things. And you can talk to them and say, hey, it's about networking. I'm offering this. You know, you could even sometimes give them a spot for free. Like if they're a good hub for you, if they've got like all the people, let them come try it out, because then they're going to talk about you all the time. They might let you leave flyers or business cards. So I think that it starts with who do you want to help? Who are you teaching? What's the theme? And then just brainstorming and get some friends together, have some tea. Where else do these people hang out? Like just start writing lists and then go from there.
Yeah, you could even partner with a baby gear store, have the classes mm-hmm. there and have them take some responsibility for filling it as well.
Mm-hmm. It's a great idea. Yeah.
If they have a good space, or if you don't feel ready to choose a theme like that, if you don't feel ready to say, I want to teach prenatal, you can also look for ready-made communities that are centered around something else, like just a community center, a church, mm-hmm. that would have to, you know, an open-minded church, a church that's open to yoga, a dance studio, a martial arts studio, look around, talk to people and look for places where people are already connected, because mm-hmm. word of mouth is super powerful. And if you can just get a few people who are excited about it and will tell their friends about it, it's much easier for people to say yes to something new in a familiar environment than something new in an unfamiliar environment. So think about the location as being part of how you're going to find students, especially if you're not ready to choose a niche.
I used to know somebody who used to do regular classes in an art gallery, and she themed them just as poetry, art, and yoga. And so she had, you know, the people from the gallery, their community, people that would come to the openings. She was able to go to those to network. The gallery would talk about her classes. So yeah, exactly. The location in that case became the hub.
Yeah. And shared interest, right? If you are a art aficionado already, this is already another passion, then it's easy for you to show up at the openings and feel good about being there and feel like you have something in common with the people there. And that's the exact right attitude that you can show up with and talk about. Come to my class, come try out my class. It's going to be right here. It's going to be amazing.
Mm-hmm. I love the idea of if any of the maternity stores have enough space for you to offer. It doesn't even have to be like a full class. It can be a sampler, but just enough to kind of get people's interest going. Mm-hmm. That's the thing, is just start small. When you're done your session, like write down, okay, what didn't go well? What went awesome? What do I need to change? And just, it'll grow gradually. It will take more work to be sovereign. And it's so worth it. So that things like pandemics don't just close the studio that you teach at. The reason that I was able to still earn a living when everything shut down is because I had an email list of people that I could email and say, so how do we feel about Zoom yoga? Let's have a coffee tea date on Zoom and talk about what this might look like and, you know, what days and times. And, you know, I was able to reach out directly to people to be able to build things.
Yeah. One thing I'm coming to realize through this conversation is that the one thing that a yoga teacher who wants to run their own pre-registered series really needs is an email list. Mm-hmm. And you do not want to be using your Gmail account. You want an actual email broadcast platform. If you want to learn more about that, I've got several podcast episodes that go into that. I'll link to them in the show notes. But if you need to pick and choose, where am I going to put my attention? What is the most important asset that I need to grow this side of my business? It's going to be an email list. Mm-hmm. Because every single person who shows up for any of your classes, any of your events, you want to be able to get back in touch with them later on and let them know about the next one. That's mm-hmm. essential. That's how you build momentum and that's how you grow. So if you're wondering, should I pick a course platform or registration software or email software, I would prioritize email. Now, we talked about OfferingTree earlier. That's an mm-hmm. all-in-one. You can email people through that and have them register for your classes and a whole lot more. So it's definitely something that's worth looking into. But if it's more than what you can afford in this moment, then choose just an email marketing platform to start.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. It's something I wish I would have done when I started my business. I started teaching in 05. I didn't start really actively trying to build an email list until 2010, 2011.
Because nobody was doing it then.
I know. And I wish, well, it was because when I finally took a business course, I was like, oh. And yeah, I wish I had, because how many students maybe did I lose contact with? I would say, even if you don't have a website yet, an email list is a good starter, because yeah. people, you can just put your email on all of your flyers or whatever, and then just say to them, oh, I can add you to my email list. And as long as you've got permission, you now have a way to contact them regularly. And then you can grow into a website, you know, as you need. But like you mentioned, I mean, OfferingTree is a great example of you can do it all. You know, you could have your website, you could have your email, you could have the registration. They really have made it so easy. Like, where was that when I was first teaching? And I was doing PayPal buttons and checks. And
we didn't have any clue what was about to happen in our culture.
Mm-hmm. True. True.
Is there anything else that you think yoga teachers really need to know about offering pre-registered series or anything that you want to emphasize?
Yeah. First, I want to just mention, for any of you listening who own a studio, I'm not leaving you out of this conversation. You too can slowly transition into registered series. Yes, you will be bucking the current system. You will be going against the grain of what other studios are doing. But it can happen, and you can start the same way. You can start small, even something like at a studio, having, if you want to get people used to pre-registering and you want to create that community vibe, start having events that are related to yoga that people, they can be free or paid, that people have to sign up for, like movie nights or community potlucks or invite people in to give talks that are related so that people get used to your studio as being not just a place where they show up, throw down their mat and run out, where it becomes sort of like a second home to them. And then they're going to be a lot more likely to offer again. If you can start offering some small themed series, your teachers are going to be happy. You're going to make more money. You're going to be getting way more loyal and dedicated community members. So I just want to mention that like if you are a studio owner listening to this, it all goes for you too. It's all the same for you as well. And so I guess the other thing that I just would mention is, you know, we've gone into a lot of the sort of practical, like how would we do this? But teachers might still not be sure why. Why would I go to all this extra work? So I would just say, first of all, there is the financial stability part and the increased income. We like this. But there's also a sense of connection and relationship building with your students. There's the community building, your ability to be able to customize for your students. When you have the same students over and over, you know that so-and-so had a shoulder injury or so-and-so has a knee replacement. And so it really gives you a lot more comfort with the students you're teaching and ability to kind of modify for them when you really know who they are because they've been coming. Not only is your income and life going to be more consistent, but you're encouraging them to be consistent with practice. So when they pay for a series, they're more likely to show up. When it's the same day, the same time, they've already prepaid. You don't have to count on them trying to, you know, run around and remember to book. And then the other couple of things I would say is that there's a continuation. I think all teachers have felt at some point when they've been teaching a while a need to dive deeper with their students. And then they start and then, oh, now there's a brand new student that dropped in. So it's like, okay, so now I'm going to rework my whole class plan and my theme because I can't continue on what we did last week because now we got half newbies and half. So that stops. You can really start to bring people through a progression of not just the poses, but also your themes, your philosophy, any of the extra things that you're like itching to share, the bigger picture yoga stuff, and cultivating some of those deeper teachings, which are really hard to do in a drop-in class. It's really hard to introduce any yoga philosophy when you got this kind of fly-by-night passing ships feeling in your class. But when you have the same group, it really gives you an opportunity to grow along together. Before you have brand new folks coming in. But also my secret hope for teachers is that they find some sovereignty in their business. And I think that doing registered series is one of the best ways to start to become sovereign, to sail your own ship so that you're not reliant on a specific location or a specific studio or even a specific corporate class or whatever model you're using now, that you really can, you know, if eventually that location doesn't work out, you've got a nest full of students that you can just move that nest to a new location because they're actually there for you and the connection and the community and their practice. And although the location can be great, it's not like the only selling feature.
I think a lot of yoga teachers start teaching with really deep aspirations for the impact they can make on their students. If you are reliant on outside sources to connect you to those students, it's going to be hard to fulfill the aspiration of why you started teaching in the first place. Mm-hmm. So taking that ownership over your business, over the format of your teaching will help you to, it will make your teaching more sustainable because you will feel like you are fulfilling your intent. You will feel like you are living your values versus often having to feel like you're compromising what you want to offer based on somebody else's expectations.
I'm so glad you brought this up. Here's a perfect example. I teach 90-minute classes. I do teach at one studio, I will say. They're kind of the special magical unicorn in my business. It's only one place and they're an exception to the rule. Their classes are a little shorter. But I teach 90-minute classes because it's important to me that we get it all in. You know, I want to do a little bit of a deeper teaching I'm a yoga therapist, so I want to make sure that it's therapeutic. I want to make sure their nervous system is really nourished at the beginning and at the end of the practice. And so I just know from, and I want to have a community check-in. So I start my classes each time with everybody says their name and how they're doing. And then I can, you know, I think of my class plans as recipes, you know, so I can take out an ingredient and sub an ingredient in if that's what's needed with the group. And I just feel like for me, and when I first started, so I'm old school that way. When I first started, all of the yoga classes were at least 90 minutes. Sometimes they were even like an hour and 45. And so for me, I've been able to stick to that steadfast and not budge on that because I run my own show. And so if students ask, well, why is the class so long? I've got all kinds of things I can tell them, but I'm not being forced to shorten what I need to do with students into like an hour class or even a 75-minute class. I'm able to spend that time really nourishing their nervous system because I have the window and the container for it. And so, and I'm able to stick to that stubbornly because I'm my own boss.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Nick, for sharing everything that you know about running pre-registered series. I really appreciate it. If listeners want to find out more about you and your work, where should they go?
My website is just nickdanu.com. I'm also on Instagram at nickdanuyoga. Always better to get on the website. We all know with algorithms, you may follow me, but who knows, right? Who knows? So yeah, if you're interested in more and you want to work with me, I do have a workshop on this. So if people are like, oh my gosh, this is so much information, I need someone to break this down, they can always connect with me.
Awesome. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Yeah, let's stay in touch. And I want to hear all about all of the pre-registered series that come out of this podcast episode. So if you listen to this and you feel inspired, reach out to mado@teachingyoga.net and let me know your theme, let me know your location, and let me know how it goes.